3 people have died in a week.
Accidents happen all the time. What makes you think it was murder?
There hasn't been a murder in 20 years.
You're saying this wasn't an accident?
Not everyone's a murdering psychopath. It's high time you realize that. You and your monkey.
Did he mean me or that?
Have you ever wondered why the crime rate is so low and yet the accident rate, it's so high?
I'm gonna bust this thing wide open.
From the guys who watched every action movie ever made and created Shaun of the Dead.
You never taken a shortcut before?
When the heat is on,
here come the fuzz. Go, go, go.
You gotta call the fuzz.
Gunfights, car chases.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Hot fuzz.
Got a mustache.
I know.
All right, we're back. Welcome to Celluloid Jelly, a very silly name for a serious podcast about movies.
I don't know if it's that serious.
No, it's probably not. I'm CJ Talbot. With me, as always, is Cesar Alejandro.
Hey, guys. How are you doing? Hey.
So how's everything going?
Okay, I guess. We had a couple revivals that we hit recently, because we talk about that a little bit later. So I've had a pretty active go of it since our last recording. How about you? What's going on with you?
Not much.
How's life?
Yeah, pretty good, I guess. Watched a couple of good movies last week, so I'm ready to go. I'm ready to do this.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
well, you said you saw a couple of good movies last week. Which ones? Like, what have you been watching?
Well, I watched 3 neo-noirs. All from the past couple of years. Cold in July, which I thought was terrific.
That's on my list.
Yeah, you should definitely watch it. It's Sam Shepard, Michael C. Hall, and Don Johnson. Sorry, I almost forgot. Really, really great movie. Michael C. Hall is like a small town guy. He wakes up in the middle of one night and there's a burglar in his house, and he shoots and kills the burglar. And that boy's father is an ex-con who comes to town and tries to terrorize him a bit. And I can't say a whole lot more about the plot, because there's a couple things that kind of like throw a wrench into the monkey works. And that's not even a thing. A wrench into the monkey
a
works.
I was confused for a second.
There's a couple.
It's like the monkey's out of the bottle. We'll continue.
All right, fine. Now I'm embarrassed.
Well, you have editorial control. You can't always cut that out.
Well, all right. So I saw Cold in July. Just kidding. No, but it's really good. It's well shot. It's got a this is becoming sort of a trend with newer films, but they're kind of going back and doing like these 80s synthesized scores, these electronic music scores. And Cold in July has one that's not, it's done well, because it doesn't really call that much attention to itself. But it kind of makes it feel like a throwback film. And it's gritty and it's bloody at certain points in the film. So I highly recommend it. I don't want to spoil anything, you know, but like I tripped over myself saying earlier, it definitely has a couple of curveballs that it throws you, plot wise.
The movie's only a couple of years old though, right?
Maybe 2014, I think. But it was great. It was recommended to me by our friend Nick. Mm-hmm. And it popped up on Netflix recently. And one night I was like, damn it, I'm just going to watch it. And it was, I was really into it like from the first couple of minutes of the movie on. So it's really good. Other than that, you know, I watched on Netflix again. I spent quite a lot of time on Netflix last week.
Trying to get rid of, whittle down that queue a little bit.
Yeah. I saw a movie called The American Side. Which is a 2016 film that just popped up on Netflix, and it is a throwback sort of 50s era. It's set in modern times, but it's like a 50s era detective gumshoe movie about this guy who is from Buffalo, New York, that sort of gets wrapped up in a plot that involves international intrigue and the idea of a lost design from Nikola Tesla that could change the world. And it's got
a little bit of sci-fi in there too.
Yeah, to be honest, it really felt like it was going after the Kiss Me Deadly vibe. I don't know if you've seen Kiss Me Deadly. Mm-hmm. You got to watch that. That's one of the greatest film noirs ever made. But there's definitely some throwbacks to that movie specifically in it. I can't remember for the life of me. I can't remember the guy who plays the lead, but Matthew Broderick is in it. Camilla Bell is in it. So it's got some recognizable people. But I thought it was good. I didn't think it was great. It had a female director, and I can't remember her name either, so I'm actually kind of, you know, worthless right now. But it's called The American Side, and if you're a fan of old film noir detective stories, you know, like I said, it's not great, but I think it's worth a watch. You know, you might enjoy it. And the last neo-noir that I visited last week was one that I was super psyched for, and it was only in limited theaters in the United States earlier this year, and it's a movie called Too Late, starring John Hawkes as a detective trying to track down the murderer of a young girl. And this one was notable because it was shot on 35mm film. It was only released in theaters one film, so it had a very small theatrical release. It did not come here to Baltimore or DC, which I was very disappointed by. I really liked it a lot. I don't know if did you ever catch up with The Tribe from a couple years ago?
No.
Yeah, The Tribe's really good. It's a film about a boarding school for deaf mutes. And it's like it basically chronicles the life of this boy who is new to the school, and he sort of gets indoctrinated to the culture, which is very corrupt. A lot of the kids are involved in criminal activities, and he kind of gets swept up into it. But the thing about The Tribe was that every scene in the movie was a long, uninterrupted take. So they would cut between scenes, but within scenes, they didn't cut at all. And Too Late, this 2016 film, does the same thing. It's essentially five scenes. It's very Tarantino-y, especially like Pulp Fiction specifically, is I think a reference point for this film movie, where everything kind of it's not completely out of order, but large segments are kind of given to you out of order so that it preserves certain revelations.
Is this the same director or anything like that, just stylistically, or like the long take?
No, it's not the same director as The Tribe. It's just stylistically. If you saw The Tribe, I think, you know, immediately, you know, this is something that would appeal to you if you liked The Tribe. But John Hawkes is terrific. You know, he's one of those guys, like, he just should be in everything. He needs to work a lot more.
So where did you see Too Late?
No, it's not on Netflix. It is on iTunes, and you can buy it or rent it on demand. But it is not available on DVD or Blu-ray yet. So I got it from Fios on demand.
Who's distributing that title?
I cannot remember. Yeah.
I imagine it being like a Radius or something like that.
It's a small distribution company. I can't remember who it is though. So. But, you know, again, if you like detective stories, if you like film noir...
That sounds up my alley, just the way you described it.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. You may find, you know, the whole thing about doing single takes. I'm really actually not that big a fan of that, because I feel like cinema is an editor's art. And that's the thing that makes cinema the most unique thing, is the editing, the juxtaposition of those images. But I think when done well, like I think Birdman's an example of that, you know, being done well. I did like The Tribe quite a bit. I liked Too Late. But there was a movie last year that a lot of people really liked. In fact, a lot of the people on the GGTMC really liked this movie. It was called Veronica. Mm-hmm. And our friend Joe and I went and saw that at the Charles when it was there. And he liked it better than I did. I did not care for it. Impressive. The entire movie is one shot. But I kind of felt like it lost something, because there were shots in the film that weren't as effective as they could have been because there was no way they could actually get to the place they needed to make the shot the most effective. So I think not cutting in that particular film was a disadvantage for it, storytelling-wise.
Okay.
So, but, you know, too late, they do a lot of really good things to stage the scenes, since they know that they're cutting between scenes and everything. And there's actually a couple of instances where they split screen, especially in the beginning, the first segment of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it worked out pretty well. So definitely recommend it. What about you?
Well, I guess the last thing we recorded was for Tombstone.
Right.
Which I guess is going to be going up sometime soon.
It is, yes.
I'm
on it.
I think I watched a handful of Westerns since our last recording.
You mentioned, I think, during that episode that you watched Alvarez Kelly.
Yeah.
What else?
Well, I mean, after we recorded, I watched this really kind of... kind of like this cheapy Western. I can't remember what year it's from.
It's like 80% of them.
The Buckskin Lady.
Okay.
It stars Patricia Medina. Gosh, I can't. This poster is like really like low quality. I can't read the names on it. But basically, it's about like this this woman whose father is the town doctor.
Yeah.
Her father, as the doctor, is kind of like a lush. And she has a reputation of being a tomboy, and she has a relationship with this tough kind of criminal type who comes in. A lot of people in the town eschew her family despite, you know, all the stuff her father has done for him. So she has kind of like a rough background until a new doctor comes in who catches her eye.
Okay.
And, you know, as you can expect, he and her, kind of like her boyfriend, it's kind of, you know, they have a relationship, but it's never like really kind of set in stone, kind of go at it.
Okay.
It's a very kind of
Does it end with a gunfight?
There are a number of guns involved, but there's certainly a lot of like the classic rolling around the dirt kind of like
sure. Fight scene. That's a big Western trope.
The movie itself actually plays itself initially with quite a bit of humor when they're introducing the characters. You know, and segments of it honestly felt a bit like watching television Western. And then, you know, towards the end, it gets very, very dark very quickly.
Wow.
Okay. And overall, I thought it was okay. I mean, it doesn't really do much. I mean, back then, a lot of those old Westerns, you know, said they're cheapies, probably shot in about a week or so.
Yeah.
But, you know, it kept my attention for, like, the very short running time. It was, like, 70-minute, 80-minute movie or something.
Yeah,
like
most
that.
Westerns were done quickly, and they were considered B-movies. Yeah. You know, it wasn't really until the 40s and 50s that it... studio priority to do.
I can't remember what year that film was. It was, I want to say like 58, maybe.
Yeah, that's pretty late, though. I mean, like that's the point where, you know, I mean, when The Searchers is late 50s, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if your name it wasn't Howard Hawks or John Ford, most of the time you got a small budget and got, you know, a B-level stars.
Sure.
So,
well, you know, we had the studio system back then, so, you know, some of those movies have big stars and just not this one.
Yeah.
Besides that,
was it put out by a major studio or was it like a Monogram?
I can't recall.
Yeah.
It may
have been a Poverty Row studio.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Besides that, I saw McClintock just a few days ago.
McClintock's
just
good.
Just rewatched it. Yeah. Liked it quite a bit.
Funny.
And, I guess it's not, people wouldn't call it traditionally a Western, but I watched an Argentinian film called, Ardor. With Gael Garcia Bernal and Alice Braga.
Oh, yeah?
Which was...
That's a new one, right?
Maybe a year or two old or so. Which, you know, I liked quite a bit. I don't think it's necessarily going to be, like, a movie that you need to run out and see. But basically, it's about Alice Braga and her family are... she lives on a mountainside with her father. And it looks like they grow tobacco or something. And basically, other families in their area, other farmers are getting kind of pushed out of their homes by like strong arm tactics by a group of mercenaries under. When I say mercenaries, more like thugs.
Yeah.
Working for like a corporation that's trying to like open up the land so they can
sure.
buy it for cheap.
Yeah.
There's a
oh god, what's it called? There's a Charlton Heston movie that's kind of like that where he's a melon farmer. I'm drawing a blank on the name of it, but that, yeah, keep going.
After that, you know, inexplicably, a man comes out of the fort.
Did I just say Charlton Heston?
You mean Charles Bronson.
I meant Charles Bronson.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like,
I'm sure. Definitely Bronson. I apologize. Keep going.
There's, Gael Garcia Bernal emerges out of the forest by himself, barefoot, and just wearing a pair of pants. And he's very soft-spoken. You know, I think I'd be surprised if in the film he said more than, more than 100 words in the entire picture. The movie itself, though, relies a lot on imagery, and it's got some very good photography in it. I can't remember who the DP was on it, but, you know, he's very mysterious. And eventually, you know, things come to head where he ends up stepping up to protect, against these, like, invaders. And I don't know if that's the right word, but, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was shot very well, and, you know, performances are good. But yeah, it's a quiet, really, really slow burn of a film.
Okay.
So the movie is probably an hour and 50 minutes or so, but you could have honestly cut out a lot of, maybe, like, The Revenant and Apocalypto had a lot of scenes where you're looking up at trees.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, it's not done as well as that.
Anything Emmanuel Lubezki shoots, you're looking up at trees. Every Terrence Malick movie he does has got, like, a ton of tree shots.
Yeah, you know, slow pan, go up a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was pretty good. I guess besides that, I can't really...
I would almost bet you that Gravity is the only movie he's made that doesn't have a pan up to the top of the trees.
Doesn't it do that, like, at the very end?
Maybe it does, actually, yeah. No, it's a low angle of her, though. Like, it makes her look huge.
And she walks out, and then...
Yeah, but it's not, like, in the middle of the forest or anything like that, though. So she's on a beach.
Well, maybe we should see that. Besides that, I caught... Oh, just last night, right before we watched Hot Fuzz... I watched it 8 days a week, The Beatles, The Touring Years.
I saw you post something about that. How was it? That's the Ron Howard.
Quite good. Yeah. With it being like an official, I guess, Apple, what is it called? Apple House Productions or whatever. Yeah. You know, you're kind of privy to a lot of footage I'd never seen before. And a lot of audio recordings and photographs that even like hardcore Beatles fans, I'm sure they'll see a ton of stuff that they've never seen before. And no other documentaries or I think... Be able to access these archives helps quite a bit.
Are you a big Beatles fan?
I'm not very much a music fan, period. Beatles have music that I've listened to ever since I was a kid. And I think anyone, even casual music fan, I like the Beatles quite a bit, but I can't say, you know, like I owned every record or listened to them or whatever. But, you know, you'd be surprised that like, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, but like how many songs you know that, like, you know, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and George Harrison wrote.
Wrote, but didn't, yeah.
Yeah. You know, that have been covered many times over the years. But, yeah, their output is astounding. And, you know, seeing them in this kind of, like, this short, like, five-year period where they're, like, you know, basically working to the point of exhaustion every day.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of interesting to see them because a lot of people only kind of remember them, you know, the years later, despite like their earlier music being their most iconic, probably.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't consider myself a Beatles scholar at all. I mean, I like the Beatles, but like,
I think if you have any affection for any of their music, I think the movie would be worth your time to sit down and watch.
Yeah.
I think long audio clips. They have stuff from like, you know, their stadium tours, and one of the things I really liked is for the short moments when they go back to the studio, you know, you see photographs of them working and like some, I guess the recording, the audio was being recorded the entire time. So you hear like, there's a short moment in the film.
Fuck off, Paul.
there's a little bit of swear, but that's not what it's about. But like, there's some very lovely, I guess I want to say maybe it's a 5 minute scene where Paul and John Lennon are talking and they're just playing little strings or whatever. And then you kind of see that develop a few minutes. You know, apparently they did a little bit of editing, but over the course of like 30 minutes, it turns into a pretty iconic song. I'm not going to say what it is because I think if you sit down and watch it and you hear it, you're like, wow, that came from like these like three notes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's, I mean, that, you know, getting a peek at the creative process that way is pretty amazing.
They have a couple talking head segments, some classic interviews and stuff. I guess the recent stuff, they did stuff with Ringo and Paul. But a couple of actors...
Oh, they're the only two alive. Yeah,
yeah. So, you know, it definitely... I mean, it's a Ron Howard picture. So I think he's able to, like, get... Yeah,
not a selling point. Not for you. No, I just, like... I mean, I really like sort of like behind-the-scenes stories, but movies or anything, you know?
Sure.
Like, you know, it could be astronauts. But, like, the one thing that always sticks out about the Beatles is that that there was always these stories about Paul kind of going behind Ringo's back and re-recording the drum solos on songs. You know, like, while everybody else was asleep, he would just go re-record the drums because he didn't like the way Ringo would do it. So
I think it's very funny, like, during the, I guess, like, the Beatlemania elements, you see a number of a lot of these really funny screaming teenage girls.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always think it's very funny whenever I see groups and groups. And there's a couple of celebrities who do short talking head segments.
Yeah.
And you know, coupled with like some surprising archival footage of them in black and white in those crowds. I was like, wait a minute.
Oh wow, really?
Yeah.
Oh nice. Yeah.
That stuff I definitely didn't realize. So, and then you know, there's funny stuff where you know, some people are like, "Oh, I love Ringo's," you know, girls holding up magazines saying, "I love Ringo's eyelashes." I was like, "I do too."
Oh man, cool. Well, I'll definitely check that out. So, I remember seeing the what is it, the Beatles anthology when it ran originally. I think it was on ABC or something. So that's probably the last time I ever watched something that was specifically on the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
That was, God, was that 20 years ago?
Like 10 years ago, probably.
Longer, it had to be longer than 10. So we'll split the difference, 15.
All right, there you go.
So cool. And then, you know, you and I both saw 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, recently.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing experience. 70 millimeter at the AFI Silver in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Yes.
It was great, so... I had a great time. So
who else was there with us?
It's just you and me in an empty theater. No. Sold out show. The AFI had Gary Lockwood and Keir DeLay there for a Q&A after the show. They signed autographs, everything was free, and signed autographs before the show, and you know, I didn't get a chance to go up and talk to them or anything, but you know, it was pretty great to kind of see them in person. And
we were in the front row, so yeah. We had very close looks at them
on purpose. We were in the front row.
Yeah,
so that's
maybe I'll
that's the way to experience a 70mm film.
Maybe we'll tag a photograph, one of the photographs you and I took to wherever this podcast goes.
Yeah,
when it goes up.
It goes out to space. The aliens
yeah.
The aliens will find it. The aliens will learn all about movies from you and I. That's
yeah. don't trust robots and computers.
Yeah. No, I mean, 2001, man, it's a movie that, you know, so many people find impenetrable. They don't like it. It's too artsy. And, you know, I think I mentioned to you as we were coming home after the show that, like, every time I see it, you know, I'm obviously, you know, I've spent years, you know, digesting that film because I've seen it, you know, maybe half a dozen times in my life. But, you know, I find it an easier watch. The time passes quicker every time. You know, I don't know if that's because I've pre-digested it or because just as I naturally get older, that I'm more interested and fascinated by the things that Kubrick was fascinated by in the story. Whereas when I was a younger man, I was, you know, looking for explosions and gunshots and the fast pace.
Did you like it the first time you saw it?
I would say that I probably appreciated it as an important film the first time I saw it, but I would say that I've grown to really love it, you know, since then.
Sure.
I think actually many of Kubrick's films are that way. Like specifically Barry Lyndon, I think is that way.
I've still never seen that film.
Yeah, Barry Lyndon is one of those movies where like most people when they see it the first time, it's just too slow. They don't get it. It's just stuffy. You know, you can appreciate, you know, it's amazing camera work. A lot of it is lit simply by candlelight, which, you know, took some research and development and him messing around with things to be able to do that at the time. You know, these really beautiful and precise long zooms in and also zooms out for establishing shots and things. But you know, I really like that movie a lot. Eyes Wide Shut, I think, is that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
I'm not a fan of that film, but I've only seen it once, though.
Yeah, see, I think I liked it the first time I saw it, definitely, but I find something new with it every time. I really love that
movie. Now, I haven't seen Space Odyssey as many times as you. I think, including the screen that we went to at the theater, that was probably my third time watching the film. Yeah. And, you know, I definitely agree that it's a film that gets easier. And, you know, the running time is pretty daunting initially, especially if you just look at it for the first time you watch it. But, yeah, like, the movie zips. I don't want to say zips. Because yeah, but like it definitely feels like a lot better paced.
Yeah.
After the fact, after subsequent views.
Well, as the moderator of the Q&A pointed out, the studio forced Kubrick to cut out almost 15 minutes of footage after the first weekend of release when it was in theaters back in 1968. So
get Gary Lockwood running.
Yeah. So we're actually seeing a shorter version of the film that was not Kubrick's director's cut per mm-hmm. se. I would love for them to sort of, you know, find that and restore it and put that extra footage back into the film. But
we'll see.
I'm not sure if that'll ever happen, but I'm sure, you know, Kubrick probably had notes on what was taken out. I'm mm-hmm. sure that footage probably exists somewhere.
Recreate it.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that Gary Lockwood mentioned was that that there was almost a full 5-minute scene of just him running on the
circular,
whatever you want to call it. Yeah, the
aisle.
Yeah, in the hull of the ship.
Yeah.
You know, just running in a circle.
He was for
5 full minutes without cutting away, which I think sounds awesome.
he's like original Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise. It's amazing. He doesn't. Does he run at all in Eyes Wide Shut?
He has to through a hallway.
I'm not sure he does.
It's like Leonardo DiCaprio. Every movie, he just, you know, gets wet.
I mean, the guy even runs in Born on the 4th of July, and he spends most of that movie in a wheelchair. So, like, that might be a real, like, honest to God, you know, anomaly for him that he doesn't run in Eyes Wide Shut. Hmm. We're getting a little off track, though. No kidding. So, anything about anything more about 2001 you want
to
talk about?
No, what's there to say? I mean, it's a classic. I think everyone owes it to themselves to see it at least once. It's sprawling. It's epic.
Yeah, I mean, if you can,
it's an experience.
If you can get the opportunity to see it on the big screen, even if it's digitally projected, yeah. I mean, we had it was an honor to see it on the big screen in 70mm. I mean, this is a really special print that they travel around the country with. Take good care of. But if you have the opportunity to see it anywhere up on the big screen, you know, do that. It's just tremendous. I think this particular time I was really kind of blown away by the sound design, not just the music, which, you know, obviously is packed with amazing classical pieces, but the sound effects in particular and the way sound is used or not used in the film really blew me away.
Yeah, I think, you know, besides Space Eyes, that we also saw Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That was a while ago.
Yeah,
did we talk about that in the last one?
No.
We didn't?
It was the
night
after we recorded Tombstone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just want to say, you know, revivals, they seem to be coming back. And, you know, I think everyone, you know, should try to hit a couple.
Well, we're lucky, I mean, in Baltimore, because we, you know, the Senator is now doing, like, 2 different revival movies a week. The Charles does a revival
movie
every
week. You can thank that family for...
And, you know, and then we've got the AFI less than an hour away, which is doing revivals all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we're in a real, you know, terrific place, you know, to be a classic movie fan.
Yeah, there's a handful of theaters, like, I guess AMC has been doing that, like, for, like, anniversaries
and
stuff.
Yeah, Cinemark, they're doing Doctor Strangelove, is it this week or next week? Might be today.
I'm not certain.
So, of course, they're not going to hear this podcast for 10 days, because... Doesn't matter.
But I think, you know, revivals are one of the things I love about the current state of, like, movie going.
Yeah.
Like, that they're coming back, because there's so many films that I love to death, but never had a chance to experience it at a cinema.
Yeah.
You know, it always gets better, especially if it's a movie and you have a great crowd who loves the film. It seems like that's what movie going should be.
Yeah.
And it's less and less the norm, especially with like first run pictures.
Yeah. To be honest, I always find that with revival shows, like I almost never have a problem, you know, the way that I do sometimes with newer audiences with newer movies and mainstream audiences. You know, most people who want to pay $10 to go see something that they could watch on their TV just to see it on the big screen, they're there because they love cinema, mm-hmm. because they love that movie in particular, you know. Or maybe they get dragged by their friends, but their friends will probably shut them the hell up if they're talking. Yeah. So, but yeah, absolutely, man. Raiders was so good too. Now Raiders was not a film print; that was DCI. That in particular, like I really loved Karen Allen's performance in that. And you know, obviously, I've seen Raiders.
I've probably seen Raiders like 20 times.
Yeah, at least. But, you know, seeing on the big screen, you really tend to, like, watching it at home, you know, I used to, like we talked about during the Hustler podcast, sometimes I would just put movies on and I would shoot pool and I would kind of watch the movie while I was doing something else. And Raiders and Star Wars and Jaws and, you know, a couple other movies, Back to the Future, would be movies that I would put on and do that with. So I've seen Raiders a ton of times, but sitting down in a theater where you're really focusing on the entire experience all at one time, watching, you know, like in particular, like Karen Allen's performance, I absolutely loved her, which it really just pains me what they did to her in the fourth movie.
There was a fourth movie?
Yeah. Not in my mind. and the other thing that struck me about it was just how amazing, you know, they shot that movie really quickly, but how inventive the staging for a lot of stuff is. There's a moment in particular when Indy and Marion are on the street in Cairo, and it's right at the very beginning of the big extended fight that ends with him and the swordsman.
Mm-hmm.
And he like kind of pushes Marion's head down and there are melons dropping everywhere and he punches a guy and a different guy comes in from the other side with a sword and tries to spear him through the gut. And he kind of, you know, he steps out of the way and throws his arms up to get out of the way. And the sword goes through a guy who's trying to hit him from behind. And then Indy takes like a sidestep and goes off and punches another different guy. But then the camera moves with him. And then when he moves back, the guy pulls the sword out of the other guy and melons drop from behind him. It's just like a really nice, like, punctuation, you know, comedic punctuation to that moment that, you know, if you're not a filmmaker on the level of Spielberg, you don't even think to do that. Like, you know, it was beautiful. It was beautiful.
It was beautiful when the guy got stabbed.
It was a beautiful moment. I'm not saying that the grotesque nature of death was beautiful. I'm saying that the filmmaking technique, man, and I guess, the imagination
I don't
display.
Know. I don't know how I can make myself clear when I use sarcasm. Maybe I should make the effort.
We're actually in the same room together, which a lot of people, when they do podcasts, aren't. You know, like, we're actually sitting across a table from one another.
Yeah.
So I should be getting it.
All right.
That particular thing might be a good segue into into Edgar Wright's Hot Fuzz, which is our topic at hand. But did you have anything else you wanted to talk about beforehand?
No, not really. I think this giggling
is a
good cutting point. And he clearly illustrates the relationship you and I have.
Yes.
Mm.
Indeed.
Okay.
Well, hey, do you want to describe Hot Fuzz?
Hot Fuzz. Okay, well, first of all, I want to say this movie was suggested to us by our friend Andrea.
Birthday is today, actually.
Yes, you're right. So this
happy
going out
birthday.
Going out to you, and whenever you listen to it, we'll see.
And you know, she made it a point to send us a message and tell us how much she enjoyed the first four podcasts. So, you know, I really appreciate that.
I blushed in front of my screen.
Yes, I absolutely love that. Thank you so much for listening. And in your honor, we're using one of your suggestions. So mm-hmm. That's great.
So, yeah, if anyone else has some suggestions, your dreams too can come true. Yeah, so, you know, shoot us a message.
You may not get showered with affection like this, but...
Okay, well, Hot Fuzz.
Awkward pause.
Yeah, there you go. Hot Fuzz is Edgar Wright's second film in the Cornetto trilogy. It's a take on police and buddy cop films. It stars Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, Jim Broadbent, and Timothy Dalton. I guess they're the four main leads, I'd say. And, you know, personally, this is my favorite film out of all of Edgar Wright's films, probably, especially the Cornetto trilogy.
I definitely think it's my favorite of his films. I like The World's End a lot. The summer that The World's End came out, I was all about it. You know, I saw it twice at the theater. I bought the Blu-ray right away. I love that movie. I like Shaun of the Dead a lot, too. Shaun of the Dead's the one I've seen the least. But Hot Fuzz, maybe
Hot Fuzz, his best movie. Hot Fuzz, I've seen 10 or 15 times, a lot.
Well, that's way more than me.
I like Hot Fuzz immensely.
I was actually watching
it. I watched it earlier this year.
Really?
Yeah, and I watched it again yesterday evening.
I watched it, like you did, I watched it late last night. And that might have been my third time watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I feel like, honestly, like, I almost feel like I wanted to watch it again because there's so much richness and detail in his movies. Like, he packs a ton of stuff in
it. We can get to it a little bit later, but yeah, there's I guess we'll talk about it as we're discussing scenes.
Okay.
But I'm going to preface this by saying yesterday evening when I watched the film, it was just the film straight on Blu-ray.
Okay.
But there was originally a 3-disc Ultimate Edition DVD set.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I got that film was because that edition was because they had a like a trivia track kind of thing that would run while you're watching it, which was full of like Edgar Wright's notes and little like,
oh wow,
like screen references and things like that. So I haven't watched that version with the notes for probably, gosh, 10 years now.
I'm gonna lean heavily on you for this one.
Okay.
Usually I'm the one with all the background and everything.
Well, yeah, like, this is all, I didn't write anything down, so it's gonna come off fresh off of my
all I've got is like a cast list, and then like I've got NWA highlighted and Greater Good.
Okay, well, hopefully I can live up to this pressure.
Yes, it's all on you.
Okay, well, the film, Simon Pegg plays a police officer named Nicholas Angel.
You know what's funny? As I was watching the credits, there's like a production designer or something on the movie that has the name Nick Angel.
He's named after him.
It really?
Yes.
Is that what it is?
Evidently, yes.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
But basically, he is this kind of like top-level London officer. Number of commendations.
Nine.
Well-trained. Nine.
Yeah. Nine commendations.
Well-trained and, you know, highly competent. He gets assigned because he's making the rest of the London police.
Right. Scene. That opening scene is pretty funny. like with Martin Freeman and Steve Coogan and Bill Nighy, when like,
do you want to take this higher?
Yeah. Right. Like, they all know his personality so well. So they're prepared exactly for what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. So they're just ready for it. So, but yeah, well, keep going. But like, there's a line like in that scene.
I can tell you while I say it.
There's a line from that scene that I want to go back to later.
How's your hand? How's the hand?
No. That's a good one, too, though.
It's okay, so basically, you know, he gets sent to this small town, this small village called Sanford, which is your postcard-esque, very quiet English town. You know, cobblestone streets, small population, farmers.
Yep.
Conservative. Exactly.
Yep.
And basically, he, you know, he has a difficult time adjusting to like his partner, Nick Frost, who is also the son of the chief of police in the town.
And from the fast paced metropolitan life to the slower paced rural life.
Yes.
Yeah.
He butts heads a bit, especially with a pair of detectives.
The Andes.
So he has a hard go of it until he discovers, you know, there might be a pretty huge case lurking beneath like the facade of the town.
Yep.
Which is very
similar to the plot of World's End,
okay,
actually. But, you know, since this was first, we'll say that World's End was copying off of this one.
Okay. Well, you know, whatever.
I guess Edgar Wright felt like he didn't get this movie right. He had to do it again with Aliens.
This movie's perfect.
So why is Hot Fuzz so good?
Now, you and I are big moviegoers. In particular, for me, I'm a huge fan of action films. And, you know, there's definitely...
Way more than I am, I'll have to admit that.
There's not a small... It isn't a small portion of the action films that don't feature, you know, at least some police element to it. Mm-hmm. So this movie is very self-referential. And, you know, it kind of... I guess in the way that... not in the way that Tarantino does it, but, like, I guess Edgar Wright...
Like, Edgar more Wright, overt, like, yeah.
He shows, like, a serious love for, like, these classic films, and...
Yeah, he name-drops, like, so many. A half-dozen movies at least, and apparently, like, the movie clips that he used, I read that not only did he have to get permission from the studio, but he had to get permission from every person who was on screen in those clips, including stuntmen.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that's, I mean, you know... It's a lot of legwork to go and put, you know, some Bad Boys footage in your movie.
I guess so. Oh, hell no. Oh, hell no. But I don't, I mean, the humor's spot on. It's got a number of great performances, but I'm sure we'll get to that in a little bit. I think,
like, every single one.
You probably...
Is there anybody in this movie that you would replace with somebody else?
No.
It's, like, perfect.
You're right.
Yeah. End of conversation. We'll see you on the next episode.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll be able to articulate it a little bit later, but, you know, after my mind can wrap around this. But, you know, there's a certain energy to it, and, you get affection for a lot of the characters, even the ones you wouldn't necessarily expect to. It's just a great time, I also say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a good jumping off point. I mean, just to start talking about Edgar Wright in general, Edgar Wright is a filmmaker that is unique. That there's not a single guy out there whose movies look or feel like Edgar Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say the same thing about, like, I'm sure people would be like, okay, Fincher, Tarantino, Guy Ritchie, Wes Anderson, you know, but Wright would be up there also as far as, like, you know, having sort of like his own thing going on. The aesthetic. And the cinematic language he uses is completely different from everybody else.
He hasn't made a film I've disliked.
Yeah.
Or even a film that I thought was just average.
Well, he's come up, I didn't take the time to look in any kind of dates or anything like that. But there was sort of like a new age British crime movie thing in the 90s and early 2000s with Guy Ritchie. And, you know, Guy Ritchie's a person who has a lot of flair and a lot of energy in his movies, too. Guy Ritchie's doesn't always seem quite as focused or well planned out as Edgar Wright's. Like, I get the feeling like
there's a certain preciseness to Edgar Wright's stuff.
Edgar Wright's stuff is like, I can tell it's very storyboarded. You know, every montage, every scene transition where he does, you know, where somebody else would use simply an establishing shot of a city to show you, okay, we're in a different place now. He literally transports you there with a quick cut montage series of things, every shot designed, you know, before or after a different one to tell you, you know, to give you a piece of the story from one place to another. So, like, for example...
It helps the film especially, like, because, you know, it doesn't... You never feel bored. It's like...
No. No, in fact, like, he takes the most mundane scenes and elevates them using that technique. Like, one of the things I absolutely love about...
The paperwork bits?
Yes. In Hot Fuzz in particular, the mugshots and paperwork stuff, which is the stuff that every cop dreads. In fact, there's a line from... who's the sergeant in the cage? The desk sergeant. I can't remember his name.
I can't remember his name. The twins,
right. But he even says, are you sure you want to do this? Because, you know, my pen's running dry or something like that. And you know, Nick Angel, Simon Pegg's character, he's double-fisted with pens, and he's like, not a problem. And then there's, like, this amazing, like, really fast, funny montage of him filling out paperwork and taking mugshots. And at that point, he just took a bunch of kids and the Nick Frost character, who doesn't know is a cop, into the station. And, like, one of the kids has, like, a like a traffic cone on his head.
The Harry Potter looking
yeah, too. So he's got to take that off during the scene. And so, like, but I mean, that stuff's amazing, you know, and it's so well thought out, so well crafted. And it's something that other filmmakers would never spend the time or energy to do. Like, they would just cut and take you from one place to another and be done with it.
You know, I think there's a certain, whenever I see one of his films, that you get the impression that he really, really, really loves cinema. Now, I didn't watch any, like I mentioned, I didn't watch any special features to go along with this film. So I'm going on memory for what I did from the Ultimate Edition way back when I owned the DVD. I'm pretty sure all that supplemental stuff is on the Blu-ray these days, though.
I don't actually own it, which I found interesting or
telling.
Yeah, I actually ended up watching it on Netflix.
Yeah.
So no special features for me at all.
Yeah, like I guess like when Hot Fuzz was released in the United States, you know, it'd been a pretty big hit in the UK for a few months, maybe half a year before we got it on these shores, I guess. Yeah. And
in the colonies.
And there's, you know, there's I don't know, a supplemental feature where Edgar Wright, Nick Frost, and Simon Pegg are kind of promoting the film across the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a couple scenes, very funny ones. I'm going to sidetrack just a little bit. But, like, there's
what we do.
Yeah. There's a scene in that supplement where they're sitting in a conference room and they're talking onto, like, a telecom, and basically they're bored out of their minds because they're calling into, like, radio stations in the morning or whatever. And, you know, like, they're talking, they're sounding excited, but, like, they're making faces at each other and you know, sound, like, exhausted, just laying on a table. And, you know, when they're about to, they're almost done, so they're talking to the last person. I don't know if this was shot by Edgar Wright or whatever. He's making faces at me, guys. And basically, I guess, like, they have a production assistant who's, you know, gonna collect them and tell them where they need to go next.
Right.
And she comes into, like, the conference room. And, like, Nick Frost, Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg are, like, laying on their backs on, like, the conference table talking to this intercom, but they don't have clothes on. Or, like, they're on their underwear.
They definitely have a great rapport. I mean, they've been working together since Spaced, so, right?
Yeah. Which I'm a big fan of.
I've never seen a single episode. That's something I really need to get one, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure it's, like, you know, it might be on Netflix or Hulu or something. I do have, like, the DVDs, but they're Region 2 and PAL.
Okay.
So, well, anyway, different supplement.
Okay.
During the promotion in San Francisco, I guess Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, they end up going to a baseball game. But before you see them go to a baseball game, they're like, yeah, an American baseball game. Edgar Wright's like, anyone want to go to the movies with me? And they're like, no. And so they leave him to go to a baseball game, and Edgar Wright goes to watch Bullet.
Which Bullet?
The
Tupac movie?
No, not the one.
The Steve McQueen?
Yes.
Okay.
So you know, like, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, you know, they have definitely a couple, like, too many beers, and they're cheering, and that, you know, I can't remember who they were playing. But, like, you know,
Where were they?
San Francisco.
Okay, so it was the Giants game. Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, obviously they're going with the Giants, I think. And then basically they get out. They're drunk. Edgar Wright gets out of the theater, and he's like, sort of like, what do you think about the movie? He's like, oh, it's great. The cinema verite, camera work, and all this. And then, like, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost are like, shut up. And they're all drunk. Just so much you imagine, like, you know, I don't know, maybe something that would happen after a soccer game slash football game. Yeah. I just think that it's funny that, like, he's,
you know, it's a match, by the way.
Yeah, I guess.
It's a football match.
Who's winning the match? But, you know, I just...
You're always ready to throw a Zoolander quote out. Like, always.
Yeah, there's this thing going around. People, like, three fictional characters. I haven't done it yet. But, yeah, Derek Zoolander was like, save this picture, maybe. Yeah, but, you know, the fact that they seem like they have
I'd be more Hansel.
Yeah. They have so much fun making this movie. You know, it's very infectious.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, yeah.
I'm just happy to be here. It's like Charlie Bucket.
They feel like... They feel to me like they're like have a legitimate, you know, love for each other. So,
yeah, speaking about love, Simon Pegg's character,
this bromance that brews between Simon Pegg and Nick Frost,
it's pretty lovely.
It is,
yeah. I'd read originally that, Nick Frost's character was supposed to have a love interest, but they wrote her out. And a lot of the lines they had written for her, they just gave to Nick Frost. And they stayed the way as they were written in an early draft of Hot Fuzz.
Okay, maybe I misheard you. You mean the Simon Pegg character was going to have
a love interest.
The Nicholas Angel character.
Yes.
Okay, but they gave those lines to Danny.
Yes.
Okay. That makes sense.
You can't turn off. When he waddles away.
I mean, obviously this is, you know, two parts buddy cop movie, you know, and then, you know, one part conspiracy thriller and, you know, one part fish out of water story. And, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, different things that are going into the making of this movie. Obviously after Shaun of the Dead and their long history together, those two actors, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, have great, chemistry together. I like the Danny character a lot. He's really like a fun loving guy, and he's very much like a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he describes what's the big Lurch character? Michael, is that his name?
Michael Armstrong.
Yeah. he's like dad describes him as having the mind of a child, but like Danny has almost like the mind and emotions of a child also. It's very endearing. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets super excited just being around the action and has
my favorite line.
He still has that enthusiasm and those dreams, you know.
My favorite line from Danny is when they're at the church. I guess after a murder at the church picnic, and like I think one of the Andys calls him a monkey, and he's like, "Did he mean?" He pulls out a frame.
You're right.
He's like, "Did he mean me or this?" All right, we gotta calm down for a second. And that's literally like my favorite like Nick Frost line in anything ever. Got the part visual gag, it's just delivery.
Well, it's, I mean, the movie's full of visual gags. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what, yeah. I know, I guess it was last week, there was a new Every Frame a Painting going around, regarding the Marvel Studios, symphonic universe.
Okay, yeah.
Well, the guy who does the Every Frame a Painting videos, Tony Zhou,
Zhao. Z-H-O-U? Zhao?
Okay.
Joe.
Tony, whatever.
Tony Joe.
Tony Z. he did a visual essay on Edgar Wright a couple years ago, and specifically references the idea that that visual comedy and, you know, gags within the frame have kind of died, and that modern comedy is all about dialogue only. And that's one of the things that definitely separates Edgar Wright, because he's packing enough into the frame and doing enough visual humor. Like, you could tell that his influences are from Mel Brooks, you know, the Abrams Zucker, you know, like Airplane and the Naked Gun movies, you know, which are full of that stuff. And I'm sure there's many others, but that's one of the things that I think separates his movies from most other comedies, is that, he's not just writing jokes, he's developing jokes and paying things off from earlier in the film.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things in this movie that get paid off or repeated. I love the crossword puzzle gag, the fascist and hag.
Yeah.
Where later in the movie during the gunfight, whereas it's a miscommunication early in the film, it's an intentional slight at the end of the film, where they call each other a fascist.
You know, I think the setup for like that final gunfight itself is pretty terrific.
Yeah.
One of the things I had seen from the that I guess like trivia track kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is that like there's a moment when the first time Nicholas is running through the town, and everyone says, you know, it's his first day there, but everyone greets him, "Hello, Sergeant, hello."
Right.
The order that he gets greeted is the order that the people attack him in. At the gunfight at the end.
And I'm not sure if this is true or not, but like I'm gonna guess that it is, and you can tell me if you've noticed. But early in the film, when Danny keeps asking him questions, like, have you ever jumped up in the air and fired two guns at the same time? Have you ever done this? Have you ever done this? Have you ever done this? They both do all those things at the end, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like, that's a great payoff.
I mean, I think that setup is actually also happens in Shaun of the Dead when you have the opening credits, and then you see, I guess, like, random people, you know, like a grocery right. girl, yep. and, you know, people walking their dogs or whatever. They come back later on in the film as zombies, which, you know, he encounters, but, you know, maybe he doesn't initially think that they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's funny, you know, like when we did our Inception podcast, we kept talking about like the level of craft and the intricacy of the plot and the way things kind of, you know, one thing leads to another in the Christopher Nolan movies like that. The same thing is true of this movie as well. There's a lot of planning that goes into every little piece, every little detail in this film.
Yeah, it's meticulous.
Yes. That was all I had to say about it.
Yeah, it is. I cut to the core of it.
Yeah, you too. the cast is just superb. Yeah, I mean, we didn't talk about all the people who are in this movie, but just off the top of my head, besides the ones we've mentioned, we haven't even gotten to Timothy Dalton, who is, like, my favorite part of this movie.
Oh, man. He's so great.
But, you know, we talked about seeing Raiders last week. Paul Friedman, who yeah. plays Belloc, mm-hmm. is the Reverend in the movie,
yes.
which is so great. Edward Woodward, who is from The Wicker Man, which is an influence on this film, story-wise. He's also the Equalizer in the original TV series, is the Doctor, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, you know, there's all kinds of people packed into this movie. It's who's, is it Stephen Merchant?
As the...
Who plays Piss Taker.
Piss Taker. P.S. Taker.
Who, yeah, like, he had an HBO series last year called, like, Hello Girls, It Didn't Last or something like that, but he's really funny.
A lot of people know him from...
He was in The Office, right?
Yeah, Ricky Gervais.
Yeah.
His long-term relationship with them.
Yeah. So, I mean, oh, and this being,
this being a what?
Well, I was about to say, this is an early film for Martin Friedman. This is before the Sherlock TV series and the Hobbit movies.
Well, he's certainly an actor who's always been working.
He's been around, but like this might have been the first thing I ever saw him in. I mean, he was in the Office as well.
Yes.
But I still to this day have not seen the British Office.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, he was well known in Britain, but it's probably the first thing I ever saw him in. And he really blew up after that. I mean, hell, he's in the last Captain America movie.
Yeah.
So
as an American,
yeah, you know, you hit it big if you're in the new Marvel movie. So, yeah. So.
Share a couple scenes with the sorry, know, Robert Downey Jr.
sorry,
Chris
Peter
Evans.
Jackson, but you know, it took a Captain America movie to really put Martin Freeman on the map. But yeah, it's just packed with so many good people in it.
Yeah, I think after Shaun of the Dead, I think you could kind of say that's the point where a lot of people started recognizing a lot of British television and film actors.
Yeah.
You know, I think it certainly had an explosion when you had, like, I guess the newer Doctor Who series coming in to, you know, to the United States in a very timely manner compared to the UK.
Well, that was right around the same time, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Because Doctor Who, they're moving into their 10th season, I think. So that 10 years ago.
Yeah, there
yeah,
we
that's, this movie's almost 10 years
you
old.
You could put it onto that.
So, and then, hey, what a coup getting former James Bond to play your bad guy.
Oh, he's terrific.
He's so fucking good.
Yeah, this is going to turn into Timothy Dalton.
I mean, Timothy Dalton, let me get this out of the way. His Bond movies aren't great, but he was maybe the best Bond. You could argue that. I mean, he's certainly the most, like, he and Craig are the two that are most like Bond as written in the books. He didn't get the shot that he should have, and... I didn't know this, but I found it out recently. GoldenEye was actually written for Timothy Dalton before they dropped him and hired Pierce Brosnan. Because Pierce Brosnan was actually going to play Bond...
Instead of Dalton.
Instead of Dalton for The Living Daylights. So, like, there's a whole sort of circular inbreeding thing going on there.
No kidding, in this village.
but imagine Timothy Dalton in GoldenEye. I mean, just that would be awesome. You know, I mean, it's the best Pierce Brosnan for a reason. It was written for somebody else. So all the other Pierce Brosnan movies after that, they just get, like, silly. So, or progressively sillier. Because Tomorrow Never Dies isn't as silly as The World. The World Is Not Enough is
I like Tomorrow Never Dies, though, quite a bit.
Well, but you're a big Michelle Yeoh fan. I think, not just I think, because of that. I think your judgment is askew on this.
You might be right.
I like Terry Hatcher a lot and Jonathan Pryce, but I don't think Tomorrow Never Dies is that good.
Agree to disagree.
Okay. Anyway, but, you know, getting Timothy Dalton was a huge coup for this, and he's so good. I mean, I can't remember seeing him in a comedy before. And, I wouldn't say I'm the biggest, you know, like, Timothy Dalton completist in the world or anything like that. I like the guy. But this was probably the first time I've ever seen him really, like, ham it up, and he's so good in it. That, like, literally that scene...
Anytime he's on screen.
Yeah, every time. Every time. But, like, when his introduction, when Simon Pegg is jogging.
That is my favorite.
In the morning.
That is my favorite.
And Timothy Dalton just starts jogging next to him, and he's like, lock me up. Hey, all of his dialogue, like, he relishes every word of it.
Yeah.
And it's so macabre. It's crazy.
Well, I think, like, you know, the first time I watched it, I was very conscious. I mean, he's hilarious. But the first time I watched it, I was like, this guy is fucking red hairy.
Oh, yeah. And that shot, I think I had this as my cover photo on Facebook for a while. The shot of him standing up in front of his picture smiling, using the same, like...
Inside his office.
Right, yeah. Like, I absolutely love that moment. Like, you could almost, like, they don't do it, but you could almost have that, like, that fake... sparkle on the teeth, you know, like just to, like, you know, with the little bell ring at the end. So,
yeah, man, I love that line. I'm a slasher.
Slashing prices.
Like, I'm a slasher of prices. It's like my discounts are criminal.
Later when he's like, I'm sure if we bashed your skull open, all sorts of secrets would spill out.
Even as good a detective as Nicholas Angel is, you know, like, that kind of stuff definitely led him in a certain direction. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, he
brilliant.
Yeah. He was right, though. They're all.
He was right, but not for the reasons he thought.
Oh, yeah. Well, you mean the scene where he just, like, lays everything out. Yeah, he's wrong about, like, the motivation for everything. Yeah. But,
everyone.
But he's still right about who did everything. Ultimately. Yeah, that's, man, it's great.
You know, Jim Broadbent is in this film.
He's great.
He plays Danny's father, or Nick Frost's character's father, the chief of police. Very lackadaisical and hands-off kind of police chief, who is revealed to be kind of the mastermind behind everything. Or the impetus for this whole, like, I guess this village of death.
Yeah. I sort of not necessarily look at him as the mastermind. I get the sense, though, that he was... not the leader of the group, that he was pulled in after the fact. Because they sort of allude to the idea that he was more of a straight-laced cop like Nick Angel before his wife died. And then
they only ever say that when he says, yeah, I was like you once.
Yeah,
that's the one kind of...
But then he became disillusioned, I imagine, and then that allowed him to sort of change his viewpoint and see things a different way, and that allowed them to sort of, like... You know,
yeah, let's take this Village of the Year thing to the next level.
Yeah. I love the fact that everyone's always eating. Now, like, that's something that comes up in a lot of movies, especially for comedic effect, just to make people eat, and it's funny.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of spit takes.
I don't know
in
why it works. Well, and Nick Angel has a spit take, mm-hmm, as well, which is funny. But, like, you know, there's a cake eating scene. There's at one point Jim Broadbent's eating, I guess it's ice cream.
Yes.
And Timothy Dalton shows up at the thing and he starts handing out biscuits, cookies to everybody.
Yeah.
I think there's something. Well, the Cornettos, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think I'm missing something too.
Well, you know, there's a dinner that Nicholas goes to when he meets the NWA.
Yeah.
Yeah. We shouldn't dwell on this too long, right? Right. They eat. They eat everyone, just like humans do.
But it's funny.
Yes. Because it's British.
They don't stop for tea, though.
You don't know. Who knows? You know, the UK is pretty overcast. Who knows when it's 4 p.m.? Anything else you want to talk about? I love this film to death. It's just, you know, hopefully if you're listening to this, you know, you've seen it multiple times.
I don't have anything else specific.
No.
I just love, I love the movie. I love Timothy Dalton. I think it's well acted. I think it's beautifully directed, shot, edited. Pacing's great. The music is good. You know, go see it. Rewatch it in this case.
Yeah. Like, I mean, Hot Fuzz, like, it was a joy to rewatch it. I rewatched it to have it fresh in my mind for this discussion today. But yeah, I watched it. It was like the fifth film I watched at the beginning of this year. So I'm never going to get tired of this film, I imagine.
It's pretty bloody, too.
It's probably the bloodiest out of all of
Edgar Wright's films. There's some grotesque shots in this movie. Yeah, the Tim Bessinger thing. And then Dalton at the end. Yeah.
He doesn't die of that music.
No, but that's still like...
When that happened, I was like, holy shit.
I know it's CGI blood. You know, they kind of get away with it because of the comedy. Same thing with the Tim Bessinger thing.
Yeah.
But
it's very noticeable, like, rewatching it.
I love the, like, the addition of the... after he gets... I don't know what you call it, but he gets that thing stuck up.
Chin paled?
Yeah. and then he's like, oh, this really hurts.
I used some ice cream or something like that.
Yeah, there's plenty of ice cream where you're going.
Oh, man.
I like the, one of the things that I think, is becoming too common is we sort of, you know, we're getting a little bit too politically correct in many different contexts. But like the way they deal with, what's her name? The only female officer. Is it Judy?
Doris Thatcher.
Yes, Doris, played by Olivia Colman. She has a very, like, dirty sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying you couldn't get away with it now, but I think people would make a bigger deal of it now. The idea that, like, they're almost sexually harassing her in some cases.
If she wasn't doing it herself.
Right. But, I like the idea that she's sort of, like, one of the boys.
Even more so than, I can't remember, that really incompetent guy with the glasses.
Oh, well, see, you know, like, one of the things...
They have the thought bubbles.
I love that, though, because, like one of the aspects of this movie is that Nick Angel is sort of like the stranger who comes to a small town and changes everything about it, which is just another, you know, a whole series of subgenre movies that this kind of, like, pulls from. And, they all sort of either kind of snap out of their funk or become more competent than they were before. And that particular guy, and I think it's Tony Fisher is the name of the character, Sergeant Fisher.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so like every time there's an accident, he sort of like turns to Nick and says, I don't know, what do you think? And then Nick will rattle off a bunch of things they should do. And then he goes, yeah, what he said. And then at the end of the movie, he's like...
He's the guy that makes the plan for the supermarket.
Like, he just like snaps into action. And it comes up with the great plan. So like he's sort of like, you know, there's a transformation there.
Well, so I mean, when you get introduced to him, he's got like a board behind him. We like a halo describing his attributes.
Oh, yeah?
You don't see that?
I don't remember that.
Like when he gets introduced to Nicholas Angel, he's sitting at his desk. He turns and looks. There's like a whiteboard behind him and like little circles all around it with like lines going to his head. And it's like, you know, unfit, incompetent, all these other like traits that this character has that, you know, I guess.
Oh, yeah?
Kind of dissolves later.
Oh, okay.
It's like you pause it and it's
I totally didn't catch that. Yeah. That's funny. Going back to the food thing, in that scene, even Broadbent has a line about making sure everybody gets their just desserts, which I love. Like, there's so much of that stuff. Like, this movie, like, I know we've gone a few rounds about, like, you not seeing Airplane.
Yeah.
But, like, you really should watch Airplane. But, like, Airplane, like, this movie is just packed with things that, like... like that, that I didn't even catch that. Like, but if I go back and watch it again, I'm gonna be looking for
you're
that.
You're never gonna miss it again.
Right, right. But I'm sure there's dozens of things that I missed that like that I would have to go back and rewatch again to enjoy. And then other things that I just, you know, maybe I didn't catch at the beginning, but they might pay off again in, later in the evening. Mm-hmm. In the later part of the film. In the evening.
Well, I mean, you know, I think we mentioned it with, like, the moderator at Space Odyssey. He'd said every time he's watched it, you know, he knows the entire script, all the dialogue and everything. You know, whenever I watch, like, this film or literally any Edgar Wright film, I, you know, you're taken by the film, but you always catch something brand new that you might have missed previously.
And, do they set up that, at the end of the film, the big confrontation is at, like, a scale model of the whole town? Did they set that up earlier in the movie?
He drives by it, or when he comes into town, I think you see it because it's by like the Sanford sign.
Okay, I don't remember them really doing much with it though. But like because when they show up, and I've seen the movie before, but when they show up at the model home, or the model home, the model of the
throw town, me your gun or I'll kill this ginger top.
Don't, well, Simon Pegg's a ginger, so watch out, for his wrath.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I just kind of felt like I missed maybe something that would set that up earlier in the lecture.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not certain, you know, maybe there's, like, a Godzilla or some kind of kaiju thing that, like, Danny has, like, a DVD that's visible for a brief second or something.
Yeah. But, it made me think of Crank 2.
No. That makes you think of that.
Yeah. Come on, you know you love Crank 2.
Oh, man, it's so bad.
It's so awesome. Crank 2 is the best.
Yeah, okay, we're never going to talk about that film.
I think we should do a whole episode on
that. Oh, man.
Crank 2.
Nope. I don't care who asks.
Oh, I see how it is. We're being selective now.
Yeah, I guess so. Selective about movies.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I had a good time talking about Hot Fuzz. So I want to thank Dre again.
Thank you.
Thanks for making me sit down and watch this great, funny, amazing, perfect Edgar Wright movie.
Thanks for giving me another excuse.
Yeah.
All right. I guess we have something coming up that's actually kind of Edgar Wright related. End of October, the Senator's doing a week revival for Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh.
And on their opening night for that, immediately after, they're doing Shaun of the Dead. For one night
that's
only.
Right.
For one night only, though. So I don't know if this is going to get up there before then, but if anyone hears it, you know, yeah, please come in. It's going to be 28th.
This one should be up on the 2nd.
Promises, promises.
On October 2nd.
We'll see.
The 2nd, the 12th, the 22nd.
Okay.
That's
okay.
That's what that's that's the goal. So next time we're going to be doing a special like double stuffed edition.
Okay. Well, I still have to. I've seen both of the films before, but I still need to get another copy to rewatch. We're going to be doing The Magnificent Seven and Seven Samurai.
The John Sturges Magnificent Seven.
Yes.
And The Seven Samurai by legendary Akira Kurosawa.
Yes.
And I'm sure we'll have some thoughts on the new Magnificent Seven.
Starring Lee Byung-hun.
And directed by Antoine Fuqua, and starring Denzel Washington, Ethan Hawke, and Chris Pratt, and many others. It's a Training Day reunion.
I like how in the trailer, all the minorities don't have any lines. I have high hopes for this one, guys.
Does Vincent D'Onofrio have a line? I don't think anybody
says something in a lot. He says something in it.
Does he?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, fine. Then
he's got like.
I mean, well. I don't know what you're saying by minorities, because I mean Denzel Washington's got plenty of lines.
Oh yeah.
So And the girl has lines too. So you're only talking about Asian minorities.
Oh, yes. Well, or yeah, I guess one of them's supposed to be a native.
Okay, fine. So be more specific next time.
Okay. Non white, non black.
There you go.
Minorities of minorities.
Yes. Which is good. I'm looking forward to that. So we'll have a lot to talk about.
You're looking forward to it more than I am, I think.
Yeah? I'm not. I'm not necessarily looking forward to the Magnificent Seven remake. I'm looking forward to talking about the original one.
I can't wait to sit down with Seven Samurai again.
I've never seen the John Sturges Magnificent Seven.
Oh, yeah. Which is, yeah, you mentioned
that's,
that.
That's on my list of shame. So I'm going to grab a copy of that and watch Seven Samurai. And, you know, we'll
cross it off that list, man.
Yeah, well, we'll do that and we'll share some love for those movies. I mean, I already have some love for Seven Samurai. So, you know, hopefully.
I have a lot of love for it.
Yeah, well, obviously.
All about it.
Yeah. That's one of the great pictures of all time.
Yeah. Plus, the Asian guys get the talk.
All right. On that note,
that's bathing. I'm sorry.
So, I think we're done here.
Yeah, I think so.
Anything else?
No. Yeah. Let us know if
you want to tell people your Twitter handle.
I think everyone knows it by now. At Junior Beho.
All right, and I'm at Setting the Frame.
Yeah.
So, if you like this podcast, share it. Drop us a comment.
Yeah, let us know what you guys want us to watch after Magnificent Seven and Seven Samurai.
We'll get better at this, I promise.
Yeah, less giggling.
I think every other podcast has been good. Mm. Yeah.
All right.
I think 2 and 4 were good. I mean, it's really not a...
So Star Trek, is this what it is?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, I guess October is upon us.
We should do a horror one.
Yeah,
yeah. For number 8, let's do. Is there a horror movie with 8 in the title?
I don't know.
We should run through 8 horror movies.
Okay,
you can do that.
All right,
you can just do. Or no, that's just dumb. Let's not do that.
It is dumb.
Dumb.
It is dumb.
What a stupid idea, CJ.
I'm glad you self censored yourself.
Yeah, sometimes I get it. Well, maybe you could pick your favorite Halloween movie to watch, and I'll pick mine, and we'll just do 2 movies.
You mean just favorite horror movie?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Favorite movie to watch this time of the year.
Okay.
So.
All right, we'll do that.
Yeah. I have no idea what I'll pick, but it'll probably be The Exorcist. Or Trick or Treat.
Yeah. I know what I'm going to pick.
House of the Devil. Man, there are a couple of good choices. Damn.
Yeah, like, you know, I can't, like, I've been wanting to watch horror films already.
I might not be able to make it just one. We might have to do more than one.
Whatever. Whatever you want, but whatever you want, buddy.
It's whatever you want.
All right. Well, I mean, you know, it's going to be in October, so I'll have watched a number of horror films by the time we record for that one. I'm sure.
Cool. Did you end up finishing Stranger Things?
No, I'm 2 episodes away from it, so okay. I haven't. Just
I don't know if you saw it, but at the Emmys, 3 out of the 4 Stranger Things kids got up on stage. And did a song and dance number for Uptown Funk.
I don't give a shit about the Emmys.
Yeah, well, I don't either, but they were pretty good.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, like, for real. So
I think the only thing I've seen, I've been trying to stay away from, like, some of that media just in case, like, you know, there might be some spoilers or whatever.
But, well, like, the kid who plays Mike is in the new remake of It, so he wasn't with them.
Oh, so he's one of the kids in It.
Yeah.
Yikes. Yeah, but I wonder what they're going to do.
The girl who plays 11, she could belt out a tune. Like, I was really impressed, actually. All right, we're going to wrap it up. We're well past an hour.
Yeah.
Okay. So, again, thanks for listening. We love Hot Fuzz. We hope you love Hot Fuzz. Tell us what your favorite Hot Fuzz moment is in the comment section.
It's got to be my discounts are criminal. It's got to be that line.
Okay, that's fine. I love that moment.
All right.
Anything with Timothy Dalton, you'll get an A+ for.
Yarp.
So, yeah. All right, guys. Thanks, Cesar.
Thanks.